This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to talk with an FGCU professor of marine science about his recent pilot study into whether people exposed to blue-green algae blooms inhaled toxins deep into their lungs. Initial findings say yes, but more research is needed to fully understand the possible health effects. We'll learn more toward the end of this hour. But first, of the many issues facing the Caloosahatchee River and its estuary, the major decline in seagrass beds, or eelgrass as it's known, is one of the most obvious signs of the ecosystem's decline. Eelgrass beds used to be found throughout the waterway and estuary, but it's changed drastically in recent years, mostly because of shifting salinity levels throughout the year, which is often caused by freshwater releases from Lake Okeechobee. And then you also have the lack of sunlight because of dark water, and more recently, the major bloom of toxic blue-green algae, which blocked even more sunlight. But a project to try to regrow small underwater gardens as a source of seeds to begin restoring seagrasses throughout the system are starting to show some signs of progress. This project is led by the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program in partnership with local citizens and a winter garden-based company called Sea and Shoreline. We're joined in studio today by the executive director of the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program, Jennifer Hecker, to learn more. Jennifer, welcome back to the show, and thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very much.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. Today's show is pre-taped, so we're not taking calls, but you can engage with this topic with other listeners on our Facebook page at Facebook at WGCU Public Media. We're also on Twitter at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Jennifer, for starters, can you paint a picture for me of what the bottom of the Caloosahatchee River used to look like in terms of the presence of seagrass?
So it used to be a sandy-bottomed river where you could see through the tannic, tea-stained water, but it was still clear to the bottom. And the bottom was covered with large areas of lush seagrass beds. They used to go all the way up to the surface. They almost would become a navigational hazard for boaters. They were so extensive and so thick.
So what happened to it then?
The management of the Caloosahatchee through the years has brought a lot of nutrient pollution, and it also has wildly changed the amount of freshwater flow. We're either getting way too much or way too little, and that has pushed the seagrasses and other organisms outside of their natural range. They can take some fluctuation, but in some cases we're fluctuating widely outside that range. So that has caused a lot of the seagrasses to die off. And in fact, in the area of the river that we did this project, there was little to no seagrass left between the 41 and 75 bridges.
So what is the bottom like now? I mean, I'm imagining that it might be more silty at this point rather than sandy?
Yes. So when we have the discharges, it stirs up a lot of the sediments in the lake, and that is discharged downstream and accumulates along the way. And so we now have the sediments that have collected on the bottom of the river. So it's really changed the whole ecosystem. We are trying to restore the ecosystem, but we have to consider all of the changes and see what we can work around versus what we can change still and, improve flow conditions, improve water quality, would make the conditions more conducive for restoring seagrasses.
Well, I'm thinking kind of from the ground up, and in that situation, if the seagrasses don't have sand to root in, are they adaptable to where they can root into the muck that's deposited after all these freshwater releases?
Well, that's one of the reasons we wanted to do this project, was to really start with a manageable small-scale project. And it was also designed to involve local neighbors and citizens who live along the river to be a part of it. But we wanted to see if we would be successful. And there are strains of native seagrasses. We tried two different species, Rupia and Vallisneria. Those are both native species of seagrasses. But we were able to work with a contractor who has selected strains of Vallisneria, or tape grass or eelgrass as it's also known, that are more tolerant of wider salinity ranges. So we were able to plant that and see whether that type of more robust strain could survive in our local tidal Caloosahatchee River section.
Okay. So, and explain to me then, why is it important to have this seagrass? What's it there for? It's not just litter. I mean, are there animals that are eating this, or what is it doing?
So it's actually providing a multitude of benefits. Seagrass is the base of the food chain. A lot of our aquatic life depends on it. Everything from crabs and fish use it, all the way up to the endangered manatee. So it sustains a lot of our aquatic life. But it also acts as a filter. It's able to uptake nutrient pollution. So the irony is that nutrient pollution can be one of those factors that makes it difficult to restore seagrasses, but seagrasses naturally can help to cleanse and filter the water to remove some of that pollution once we get them established again.
Well, one of the, one of the words we hear tossed around a lot is filter marshes. So it's almost kind of like a filter marsh, but actually in the river.
Exactly.
Where you really critically need to get these nutrients out. Also, do these eelgrasses help to oxygenate the water?
Yes. So they are very helpful in that regard.
Because we hear a lot about dead zones, you know?
Correct. And that's also related to the nutrients. So as they uptake the nutrients, then they are keeping that river water quality better, where those types of anoxic conditions are less likely to occur. So it's just, again, like a domino effect of different benefits that we get from these seagrasses. And that's why it's so important that we restore them.
So, we see on Facebook these videos that go viral on social media, and we've seen these manatees kind of crawling almost out of the river, and they're trying to get to the grass that is growing along the banks. Is that because of the lack of the seagrasses in the river?
Yes. We do know that the manatees are really struggling right now, and this is one of their primary food sources. So, we have to put exclusion cages over the grasses after we plant them just for an initial period until they're rooted to allow them to get established. But then we're going to remove those cages shortly and allow them to be grazed upon. And we're hoping that eventually we're going to get enough funding to expand this project to have a critical mass of seagrass that's available for the aquatic life, like manatees, but still have enough remaining that it can continue to expand and flourish in the river. And we will also be working on some water quality improvement projects that hopefully will also make the conditions more conducive for that growth.
Well, it's interesting as I saw the pictures of the little areas that you have kind of cordoned off with the little cage around the little baby eelgrass. And they're small little patches. But were those put there in order to prove that you can actually do this and then you want to scale it up?
Exactly. So it's just an initial pilot project, if you will. There is a much larger project that's going on with different partners involved upstream, and they're trying it on a larger scale where the conditions are hopefully even better. But we want to maintain this in the tidal Caloosahatchee in the section that we're working on as well. And we're hoping that if we can scale it up and we can improve the water quality conditions, that we can see a restoration of those large extensive beds that once occurred.
So take me back to the very beginning. When did you first plant these little seedlings?
So we worked very closely with a nonprofit organization in the area, Caloosa Waterkeeper, and they actually were the ones who approached us originally with the idea of wanting to work on this, and we helped to write a grant, and we did receive grant funding through the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, Florida Coastal Management Program, with monies that originally came from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So all that money
passed down the river.
Feds to the state and from states to us. And then we worked with this community partner who provided technical support, provided volunteers. We also had some of our own volunteers, and we trained them, and we got them out there to plant these grasses back in June, so about 6 months ago now. And since then, we have tried to periodically go in and check on them, but we were very limited because of the toxic algae bloom, and we did not want to expose our volunteers to that. So we really weren't sure what we would find.
Well, I remember seeing way back, I think it was in August, you were wearing a gas mask out there because you were having such bad respiratory reactions to this blue-green algae. Did you see any impacts? I mean, I know you tried to not visit it too often during the height of the outbreak, or height of the bloom, I guess I should say. But did you see that blue-green algae having any impact on those little seedlings?
Well, we know that algae can block light, and that we believed would have a negative impact on these grasses. Because the water was so murky and so discolored and coated essentially with this algae in many places, our volunteers were not able to observe the grasses when they were going out to monitor them. So we were fearful that they, in fact, had not taken and that we would not have any grasses. Finally, the water cleared and the toxicity levels lowered to the point that we could actually go in the water and snorkel and go underwater to observe what was actually going on. And that's when we were pleasantly surprised to see that they had taken hold. Obviously, they would have done better if the conditions were better, but they did survive through the bloom. And in fact, they were spreading through rhizomes, runners, and they were also flowering. And that's the first time we've seen that in over a decade in the Clusatchee, in that portion of the Clusatchee, the tidal portion.
Well, that's some good news, though. I mean, it's not, you know, all sunshine and roses at this point yet, but it's a glimmer of hope, right?
Exactly. That's what we're really excited about. It just shows that if we can get the conditions right, we can restore these resources back to similar to the healthy conditions that once existed.
Do you anticipate there being much difference between different places where you put this eelgrass, this particular strain of it, or what was the name of it?
The Vallisneria and the Rupia.
That one.
So we're looking at right now doing a more extensive study to measure exactly what coverage. Visually, quantitatively, we noticed at the site that we went to recently that the Vallisneria seemed to take better. But we're going to look across the five different sites that we have set up. They're on the North Shore and the South Shore. So we are seeing some differences between the sites, and we want to understand why we're seeing those differences and use that to guide our decisions and how we plan future restoration.
Mm-hmm. And a few weeks ago, you led a press tour of these gardens, and I know our reporter went out on that. What was the impression that people were getting? What kinds of things were you hearing in response? I mean, you're kind of deep in it and do it every day. What was the impression it gave to people?
Well, I was taken that everyone was genuinely excited because they could see immediately the life that surrounds these. The fish are attracted. We saw a stingray that kept circling the area. It's an attractant for so much life. And so I think everyone was genuinely excited that this is the type of positive impact that we can make. And not just government, but working with community members who are directly living along those stretches of the river, we can bring this river back.
What is next? So you have another grant program going through and you're trying to expand it. Do you have any timeline on that?
No, at this point we do not. We are finishing out this, which is not done yet, this project, and then we'll be looking for additional funding. We're really struggling right now. In fact, I just had a meeting this morning with one of our local state representatives about getting enough funding consistently to be able to build up these restoration efforts. They're multi-year efforts. Right now, we depend on annual appropriations that are very uncertain. So it's very hard to plan and execute projects. I mean, these projects require permits. We might go forward and get a permit and then find we don't have the funding to execute, and then the permit expires. That's why it's so important that we have recurrent dedicated funding for estuary restoration. And we're working with our state legislators to try to get that.
Things that you can count on so you can plan ahead. And as you said, it's a multi-year situation that you're looking at.
Right. We want to be able to predict a certain amount of base funding from year to year so that then we can plan these multi-year projects more successfully and be able to execute them more quickly.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to change directions now from brackish to saltwater, where another critical issue has surfaced recently, the cause of which still unknown. We're turning now to Joanna Fitzgerald. She's the director of the Von Ark's Wildlife Hospital at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, which has been on the front lines for more than a year now as we face these harmful algal blooms and the animal illnesses and deaths that have come along with them. Joanna, welcome back to the show. I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy day to speak with us.
Sure. Thanks for talking with me.
Before we start asking questions, I wanted to play a short piece that was produced yesterday by our reporter Andrea Perdomo about a new apparent sign of these troubled times for wildlife. Now, birds have been dropping out of the sky onto a Marco Island beach. Let's listen to that now.
It's okay, baby. On a beach in Marco Island, Colleen Gill has just emerged from the Gulf of Mexico holding a shorebird that she just pulled from the water.
Sorry, I didn't want it to drown. Let's see, dropping out of the sky. Literally dropping out of the sky.
For the past 3 weeks, she and other volunteers have found dozens of sick or dead birds, mostly small, migratory sandwich and common terns.
There's been really extreme situations where they're convulsing and dropping dead, like right in front of you. It's not a slow, delayed process. So a lot of the birds that we are scooping up, they aren't even making it to the wildlife hospital alive.
Gil meets up with Joanna Metzger, who's pulling a blue wagon behind her.
How are you?
In it are sick birds she's gently placed in towel-lined shoeboxes.
This one can still move a little bit, but he's definitely feeling the effects.
This one didn't make it. Gosh.
Volunteers like Metzger and Gill rushed the sick birds to the Von Arcs Wildlife Hospital in Naples, where only 8% of the birds that make the car ride survive. Hospital director Joanna Fitzgerald said she's never seen anything like it.
The hard part is most of them are dying within an hour or so. We're not even getting into a real solid treatment plan that we know will work because they're passing way faster than we can help them, honestly.
Right before Thanksgiving, Fitzgerald says they sent tissue samples to the state to determine what's killing the birds, but haven't heard back, so there's no official cause yet. In the hospital parking lot, Metzger reviews the fate of the patients she brought in this day.
Three died on the way. The one that fell out of the sky is a laughing gull, and the other is a common tern, so those are the two that are alive. I had five that are deceased. You know, it's just never ending. So I just don't know when it's going to end. When everything's dead, are we next?
Back on the beach, Colleen Gill is walking among the remains of birds that didn't even survive long enough for an attempted rescue.
So they came through, they grated the beach, and they didn't pick up the birds. So now we have dead bird pieces all over the beach. Another piece over here. This is great for tourism.
She glances at a small flock of terns out near the edge of the water. It's about a third of its normal size, and then continues walking in search of birds that need saving. Andrea Perdomo, WGCU News, Marco Island.
If you just tuned in, I'm joined on the phone by Joanna Fitzgerald, who we just heard in that story by Andrea. Joanna is the director of the Von Arcs Wildlife Hospital at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. I'm also still joined in studio by Jennifer Hecker from the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. If you'd like to make a comment on today's show, which is pre-taped, you can do that at Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Or we are now live, so you could also give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Joanna, I wanted to ask, how long before you have information on the cause of the deaths of these birds?
Well, I think it will probably be at least another week. It does take time to run the tests. You know, they have the people with the state lab have been checking in with us, but it does take time to run the tests and see what develops from the different tests that they're running. So I'm hoping maybe within a week, week and a half, that we might have at least some information on what is the cause, how we can treat it, but that still, you know, opens up the question, if we do have answers, where are they getting into trouble, what's the cause in the environment. So it's still going to be a long process before we really know what's going on.
I find it's just kind of scary. You know, I know that you've been dealing with a lot of animals that have been impacted by red tide, and I'm wondering if, in your experience, if these birds are reacting in a similar way to other birds that we know for sure were impacted by red tide. A lot of people want to point the finger immediately to it, but of course, as a scientist, you need to make sure that that's really what's going on. Are they acting similarly?
They are not acting similar to what we typically see with red tide patients. So I definitely have not been able to make that correlation at this time. It doesn't mean, you know, each species can show different signs of brevetoxicosis. So just because I haven't seen red tide in common terns or sandwich terns doesn't mean it isn't, but typically you will see neurological issues, and we're not seeing neurological issues with the sandwich terns and the common terns. It's a very different presentation when they're arriving at the hospital, compared to what we would see in a pelican or a laughing gull or a cormorant. When they come in with toxicosis, they all show very similar symptoms. But these red tides, these terns are just not showing those signs.
What kind of signs are they showing? Just tired and...
Well, they're just very down. They're very weak. And typically they are in a bit of respiratory distress. The respiratory distress increases slightly, and then they pass away. So, we obviously here, at the very minimum, we are able to euthanize them humanely so they aren't happening to die slowly from whatever is causing this issue. Like I said, some have made it. We do have a few that have made it, but we've also seen the progression now in, over 100 birds. So it's easy to tell if they're deteriorating once they're here. We aren't going to just let them slowly linger. We can at least offer that humane euthanasia.
It's just so alarming, the number. I know it's a migration period, so there just happened to be a lot of them in one place at one time, but all of that happening. It's got to be overwhelming working in the hospital, and you keep seeing these people, the volunteers that are rescuing and trying to help rush them in, and it just kind of the end is only 8% are surviving.
Yeah, it's really hard numbers. And, we are getting so many in every day, but each animal still, gets the check-in, gets the exam, gets a treatment to at least start the process. It's an extra sometimes 20 animals a day, aside from the typical patients that we get in every day from car strikes and dog attacks. So it's that added layer of intense patient care that we're really trying to give. It's a lot right now.
Yeah.
And you just feel horrible for the birds. That's what's so sickening, is you just feel horrible for them. They have no escape from whatever is causing this, because it's, in their environment, and that's the sad part.
Are you treating it in a palliative way, as if it is a toxin that they have ingested or breathed or whatever? Or how are you treating them when you do? Is it just trying to keep them clean and safe?
Well, we are sort of trying many different modalities. Yes, we are treating as if it could possibly be a toxicosis. We're also providing antibiotics in case that could help, in case it is some type of bacterial infection, something like that. So we're trying everything almost, because we don't know the answers yet. So typically we wouldn't do that, but our vet has consulted with the veterinarian from FWC, so that does seem to be the recommended protocol right now, is to try several different modalities to see if there is any success with that.
All right.
But again, if you're passing away within an hour, you're just not getting the treatment started and into the patient, and they're already passing away. That's the hard part. We just need a little bit more time, and unfortunately a lot of these birds, they don't have it. And
The time they're showing the signs,
exactly.
It's kind of already close to too late. And you've seen with the toxicosis, what I've been hearing from everybody and from you before is that the only thing you can really do is just try to, wait it out. And if there's no time to wait, then...
That's it. With the toxicosis, most of the time the toxicosis patients are coming in and they're still standing. They might be wobbly and falling over, but most of them are still early on in the process. So if we can flush those toxins soon out of their system, that's what's giving us the turnaround and the survivability. These ones, again, you've barely done the first treatment and they're already either deteriorating, where it would be inhumane to not perform euthanasia, or they've already passed away. Like that recording said, some of them don't even make the trip from Marco to here and they've already passed. So,
yeah. Jennifer, I'm going to turn to you. What is the overall picture right now of the presence of red tide along Southwest Florida's coastline? I know that we're not saying that that's what is causing all of this, but I just want to ask, what is the red tide situation now?
Well, the last reports that are available are from last week, and it was still low to medium to high in different areas along Southwest Florida. So it's sporadic, but it's still present. And I think what you're hearing, you know, certainly there's uncertainty, and it's an incredible service that the Conservancy provides in treating these animals and getting to the bottom of this. But, you know, we're very concerned about biomagnification of this toxin as it works its way up the food chain.
And that's a big word there, biomagnification. Explain
yes.
that real quick.
So,
break it down.
So, you know, big fish eat little fish, birds eat fish, you know,
gets
so
into
it
bigger,
works
larger
its way
larger.
Up the food chain.
Yeah.
And as it does, it can become more concentrated and affect higher and higher species. So, you know, we're very concerned about that. And, you know, this is lingering a long time, and it's really having a substantial effect on our aquatic life and our shorebird population, as you're hearing.
Yeah. And Joanna, we were initially going to bring you into the discussion because of the high number of dead dolphins that are washing up on local beaches before these birds started dying. So I want to pivot to that now. Are you seeing anything? Are you hearing anything about all that? We had like, what, 42 dolphins in a week show up on area beaches?
Yeah, I haven't been as involved with the dolphins just because we don't do marine mammal rehab here. But I know, yes, in the past, I think week to 2 weeks, there have been alarming numbers reported of dead dolphins in the area.
And how about biomagnification? Is that something that concerns you going into larger species of animals? Are there other animals that are along the shore that could be impacted by something like that?
Well, and until we know the cause, I think it's a very real concern because, for one thing, we know right now peregrine falcons are in our area. They've migrated here, and they do hunt shorebirds. And so the first thought is if we have the peregrines that are down along the coast, along Marco Island, and they're most likely going to peck off the birds that are looking weaker, is it going to be transferred through the food chain that way? So it's definitely a big concern.
And I'm wondering about the importance of cleaning the deceased animals off of the beach. I mean, they're in such numbers that they're just there. And there's going to be carrion. You're going to have, you know, vultures perhaps, you know, feasting upon
I'm
that.
Sure, there's, yeah, quite a few different type of scavengers that would definitely take advantage of that food source. Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting to see what the laboratory results come back with on the birds down there on Marco and see if there could be, you know, even the scavengers then being impacted by consuming those animals that have passed away.
Right. Is it going to be just an avian issue, or is it going to be an issue that can cross species, you know, into mammals or not? That'll be the interesting question.
I'm just thinking of like raccoons and all
exactly.
those little guys out there, you know, and pets. You know,
sure.
It's definitely, if I was living in that area and had a pet out there, don't let them off leash and just go wandering around and finding treasures along the beach that, for a pet would seem like that. But if you're just joining the show, I'm joined by Joanna Fitzgerald. She's the director of the Von Arx Wildlife Hospital at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, and Jennifer Hecker. She's the executive director of the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. If you'd like to join our discussion with a comment or a question, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Jennifer, we're now in the second year of this persistent red tide bloom, which is, while not totally unprecedented, it's certainly not normal. But are there concerns among people in your world that this could become a new normal?
Yes. In fact, there's some scientific literature by Dr. Larry Brand that suggests, you know, looking at data from 1954 up through the early 2000s, that this is increasing in its frequency and abundance, and that it is related to human nutrient pollution. Basically, the conclusions of looking at the data throughout that time period was that this is more abundant near shore than offshore, even though it can originate offshore, that the concentration levels tend to be higher near shore, which suggests the human pollution could be fueling some of the growth of this. And then also that it's 13 times more abundant over that time period. So, you know, the fact that, yes, going back in recorded history, this is a natural organism, and there have been documented instances of red tide going back over 100 years, but that in that time period, relatively short time period, that it's become 13 times more abundant. And so seeing those those types of numbers, we're concerned about the frequency, intensity, and duration increasing, and what can we be doing? There's a lot of contributing factors to red tide, many of them that are natural that are outside of our control, like temperature and salinity. But there are things we can be doing to control nutrient pollution. So that's where we're really putting our focus on, trying to make sure that we keep nutrient pollution out of our waters and then clean up the nutrient pollution that's already in there.
And while and simultaneously trying to get that eelgrass to come back.
Exactly. And we see that as a natural strategy for trying to help to cleanse the water. And so there's not always artificial technological ways. I mean, we are exploring some of those, but we think the best ways are the natural ways. So using oysters, using seagrasses, you not only get that water quality purification benefit, but you're also getting the aquatic habitat and food source for our aquatic life.
Exactly. And Joanna, I'm going from water to the air and the earth. I want to ask you about doctors like yourself. I mean, what kind of reactions have been happening within your professional world as far as being able to step up in the face of what has become like a bigger and more prolonged issue with things like red tide and other things like this?
Well, the hard part is we're a nonprofit. From our perspective, it just does tax our resources for sure. You know, there are so many animals that can be affected by it, and just the length of the beaches that we have in our area, that it does become a resource issue for us, unfortunately. We don't have so much the people out on the beaches working, but I know many, many different levels of the economy have people on the beach, whether it's for recreation or scientists who are out doing research, and for them to be exposed to the exact same things that all of these animals are being exposed to. So there's just such a huge impact. It's just so wide. I think that's the concerning part. You know, with all the fish die-offs, does it then make it harder for these birds just in general to find food to survive? So there's so many impacts that we're all obviously very aware of, yet feeling helpless to be able to alleviate that without support.
I think it's interesting, Joanna, with you as a veterinarian, I can't imagine that the thing you thought you'd be seeing so much of would be toxicity.
Exactly. And I want to make sure you're clear. I'm the director. I'm not the vet at the hospital. We do have a staff veterinarian. That's Dr. P.J. Deitchel. So we work closely together, but she is the veterinarian doing all of the medical diagnosing and then the staff working along with her.
Yeah, but directing the hospital, you're definitely seeing all of it.
Yeah. And you know, I've been here for almost 25 years now. So it's been a big change over those years of what we're seeing, particularly in relation to red tide.
Exactly.
So one thing I'd like to add to that is just the seasonality. That was another thing that Dr. Brand really pointed out in his research is when these events occur and how long they occur is also going to affect what wildlife are impacted. And I think that Joanna hit on that very well, in that now we're seeing migratory species that are coming through at a time of year when maybe historically red tide events were not as likely to be occurring. So, you know,
it's like first exposure.
Exactly.
First time they've run into it, because it's never really going on. We saw that with the sea turtles too this year.
Correct. And it's additional species that are going to be impacted that haven't historically. And then it also, of course, affects us economically because it's running more into our tourist season. And we're seeing people, you know, not only have public health impacts, but, you know, turn away from renting homes, buying homes, staying in our communities, which has a cascading effect throughout our community economically. So, you know, there's so many different dimensions to this, but the fact that this problem is becoming more frequent, more severe, is something that we need to address.
And Joanna, I wanted to ask before we let you go, I know you're very busy there, but I wanted to ask real quick, what kind of pointers would you like to give people if they happen to be walking along the beach and they happen upon a turn that appears to be just really tired and unable to stand up? What kind of things do people need to do?
Well, I think everybody needs to know, obviously, this is going on, so be prepared. If you could have a towel with you, even a small box, you know, a lot of people are using the plastic bins. You want to make sure that they have some type of ventilation, but help them. You know, these animals are not healthy. They need us to intervene to get them the care that they need. So, you know, gently covering them with a towel and getting them right into that box with this cold weather coming, that's going to be another impact on already sick birds. They are going to be suffering over the next couple of days with it dipping so low with the temperatures tonight. So it's more likely to see another uptick in the admission. So be aware and do something to help. You know, you can make a difference. So please don't hesitate. If you're concerned, call us. We can give you tips. But covering the bird with a towel and just getting them placed into a box and bringing them in is the best thing they can do.
Maybe anecdotally, I've seen putting towels over their eyes. Does that help anything or make them panic more?
No, that's the best thing, is to get their head covered. The darkness calms them down. Most of them are already unable to open their eyes, but it still is that darkness that helps them stay calm, reduces the stress of being handled. So, yes, cover the head, the body, and then just gently set them into the box. You can leave them covered because you probably wouldn't have them wrapped tightly in the towel. It's literally just laying it over them to give you the ability to pick them up gently and setting them into the box.
Yeah, you don't need to wrap them up like a tight
nope.
burrito. Just
nope.
put a...
Nope.
All right, I get it.
Yeah, thank you.
And where would they go for more additional information? Does your website at the Conservancy?
Yes, theconservancy.org. We have a lot of information on there from our policy team as well. The hospital is open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day, even on the weekends. So we're available if people have questions about something they're seeing. They can call us. We can talk them through the situation. But they're also just able to bring things in without calling ahead. If you found an animal, don't hesitate to bring it in.
And, of course, I'm sure you're probably also looking for any kind of support from anybody who wants to help that hasn't found a bird at this point, that just wants to try to throw something in there to give a little assistance to the Conservancy and the Von Arx Wildlife Hospital.
That would be greatly appreciated as well, definitely.
Well, you're definitely taxed. You've definitely got a lot going on over there. Thank you so much, Joanna. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
You too. And Jennifer, I wanted to turn back to you real quick. Are there opportunities for people to get involved? I know we were talking about the eelgrass, and it was a bright, shining, exciting part of the story that we have the bad news. But back to the good news. Are there ways for people to get involved in that?
Absolutely. If you go to chnap.org, our website, you can see a Get Involved tab. We have monthly events where we that are free of charge, of course, for volunteers to figure out different things that they can get plugged into. We have resources. We have a red tide fact sheet. We have different information on there about harmful algae blooms. So, yes, please take advantage of the website as a resource and feel free to communicate with us, call us, or email us if you have any questions.
And at chnep.org.
Correct.
And we also have a link to that on gulfcoastlive.org if you forgot or didn't get a chance to write that down. But that's all the time that we have for this part of the show. But I want to thank my guest, Jennifer Hecker, the Executive Director of the Charlotte Harbor National Estuary Program. Thanks so much for coming in and talking with us again.
Thank you.
And also Joanna Fitzgerald, the Director of the Von Arx Wildlife Hospital at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, was with us earlier, and I appreciate her taking the time to talk with us, too. When we return, we're joined by Dr. Mike Parsons. He's a professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of FGCU's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. We're going to learn more about a new pilot study that he conducted that looks into how far airborne particles of blue-green algae toxins make it into the lungs of people who are exposed. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.